Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Today my guest is Frank Baratt. We're back talking about occupied Palestine again, and a special tribunal that Frank is involved in. Frank is a member of the UK-based Palestine Solidarity Campaign. It was formed to work for peace and justice for Palestinians, and he's also a member of the organizing committee, Russell Tribunal on Palestine, that seeks to reaffirm the primacy of international law as a way to settle the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm sure listeners like me believe in the sacred institution of international law. Without it, only the law of the jungle exists, and sadly, that's what seems to govern so much of the world, so much of the time. It's people like Frank and their initiatives that want something much better than this. We certainly do on this program. The Russell Tribunal of Palestine was created in the same image as the Brussels Tribunal that began back in the 1960s related to the war crimes of the Vietnam era. And the inspiration is Bertrand Russell, the extraordinary man, any war activist, mathematician. He should be the inspiration for all of us and others like him. But we want to talk about the tribunal and its work, what it will do. And it's an urgent mission. I've said a number of times in this program that unless we can resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict equitably, not papering it over, not favoring one side against the other, but an equitable solution. Short of that, I see no hope at all for peace in the Middle East overall. So that's the Gordian knot that has to be cut. And we need efforts like what Frank is involved in to do it. Frank, welcome to the program.
Hi, Stephen. Good to be here.
It's wonderful having you on. We want to talk about the tribunal and the work as it gets going and your aims and you hope to see come from this. You certainly have this program support. And I would just say that yourself and anybody else involved in the tribunal has an open invitation to come back anytime and talk about things as they progress ahead. We have a few commercial breaks, one coming up very shortly, but why don't you begin and discuss the tribunal? When you hear the soft music, the break is coming, and okay. I'll interrupt, and then we'll come back. But please begin, Frank.
Okay. So, yes, thanks a lot, Stephen, for having me on your show. I've been listening to it, thanks to you, a few times already, and it's I think you're doing a great job. Anyway, I'll start to say you've explained the tribunal quite well already, and I've read your article that you wrote yesterday or 2 days ago, which was very good and clear about the tribunal. To start again, I mean, the Russell Tribunal is a civic initiative, and we intend to promote international law as a core element of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. In a way, we're going to use the tools of the UN, the US, or the international community, and to prove that they are respected sometimes, but never when it concerns those institutions. So that's the main goal of the tribunal, and we intend to be not biased, because if we are biased, it means that international law, humanitarian law, and the Geneva Convention are biased.
Frank, let me interrupt, because yeah. They'll break away, and then we'll pick it right up when we come
okay.
back.
Okay, no problem.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Frank Baratt, talking about the Palestine Tribunal. Frank, continue with what you were discussing.
Okay. What we intend to do, actually, is to go further than Israel's responsibility in all this. we intend to actually demonstrate the complicity of third states and international organizations, which in a way through that passive or active support have allowed Israel to violate the rights of the Palestinian people. And we also intend to go back as far as 1948. It's not going to be a tribunal about the Gaza so-called war. It's going to be a tribunal that will analyze and examine all relevant issues since 1948. So obviously we do not have any legal ground in a way, because we're not part of the UN or anything. But what we try to do is we actually designed as a big, large communication event with hopefully widespread media coverage over the tribunal and its outcomes. I think we will succeed if we have enough impact of public opinion and we manage to mobilize public opinion. So, the latter could put pressure on its government and then they could change their strategy towards the Middle East and the Israeli-Palestine conflict.
Frank, I think that's the key. It could be, to at least some extent, Israel shot itself in the foot during the recent Gaza conflict, Operation Cast Lead. It really angered people all across the world. I was really astonished at the street protests that took place, if not on every continent, dozens and dozens of countries right across Europe, in at least five dozen U.S. cities, in much smaller numbers than in places like where you are in London, in Paris, in Berlin, Rome. It's really astonishing how many people came out, 100,000 people in some cities coming out on the street protesting Israel's three-week attack on Gaza. But I agree with you that I think it's important to go back to 1948, the war that led up to Israel's, what Israel calls its War of Independence. That was the supreme crime that Israel committed. And I've written some on that, and Alain Pape, has been on this program, wrote an incredible book called The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, official records showing exactly what went on during that war. Horrific. Mm.
And that's what's very important. What Alain Pape done, for example, he's obviously a supporter of the tribunal. What he's done is he's taken the official facts, so he cannot... So you cannot, be accused of subjectivity or bias. You've got the fact, and that's what we will do as well. We are going to use international law, the Geneva Convention, the UN Charter, to the letter. So we can't be accused of being biased. We just basing our examination, our tribunal on international law, which has been created by the power that we're going to judge in a way. But I totally agree with you about the Gaza onslaught. Israel shot itself in the foot. And I think it showed again that Israel impunity has reached incredible levels. Israel can actually, or feels that it can actually do anything it wants now, and that no one will say anything about it. And I think part of it is true, because the Gaza war was finished mid or end of like 19th of January or a few days before, and since then there's been as far as I know, no rockets fired to Israel, or maybe five or six rockets in 5 months, but the Gaza crossings are still closed, and the blockade on Gaza still exists, and there's still Israeli incursions into Gaza. So people tend to, because of the media coverage and the media, at least the mainstream media propaganda, people tend to forget history very quickly. I think it's important to remind them that there's no rockets flying into Israel right now, but Palestinians in Gaza still die every day. I saw a program on Al Jazeera 2 days ago showing a 2-year-old baby in Gaza who needed surgery, very important surgery. There's not you know, many hospitals in Gaza which can provide such surgery. So he had to go to Israel. But his parents only, you know, to apply for a permit, it took days and days and days. And the day they got the permit, the baby died. So people still die in Gaza, and there's no rockets into Israel. And that's a very important fact, and it's very important for people to know this. Going back to the U.S. and the protest after Gaza, I think even if there was the protest was smaller in the U.S. than in Europe, for example, I think it's very important that protest happened in the U.S. because I think that that's where the war, our war, activist war, has to be won. The U.S., we know this, has been a staunch supporter of Israel for many, many, many years. And the media coverage, at least in the U.S., and again, I'm talking about mainstream or corporate media coverage, has been ridiculous in the U.S. They've just completely avoided the facts. And it's very hard for the, you know, the public opinion and the population to know about a conflict if all the media actually do not, you know, don't show what's really happening. So it's very important that protests happen in the U.S. And we really hope that the tribunal will have one session in the U.S. We also hope to have a very strong national committee in the U.S., so people working sort of on behalf of the tribunal in the U.S., because that's where public opinion has to change, and that's hopefully with a new administration, if public opinion is strong enough, we might, you know, have a glimmer of hope there, a glimmer.
Oh, I agree fully, Frank, and of course the U.S. is Israel's most important ally. We supply Israel with billions of dollars annually in aid in military weapons and the latest technology, in interest-free loans. Often they don't even have to be repaid. Nearly anything that Israel needs or wants, it gets. And this is money that goes to build illegal settlements on stolen Palestinian land, this hideous separation wall that's also built on about 10% of stolen Palestinian land, West Bank land. Mm. This is really an alliance made in hell, and we need to do something to break it up. As far as the media here, it is absolutely outrageous right down the line, Frank. Whether we're talking about covering Israel-Palestinian issues, almost anything else of importance, it is really rock bottom, bottom of the barrel basement. It never was good, but it really just continues to sink lower and lower and lower. I ran across a quote that I used in one article just recently. Going back to the 1960s, when we had Walter Cronkite on CBS News every night, as far as corporate media goes, it just didn't get any better than Walter Cronkite. And the head of CBS News at that time, back in the 60s, a man by the name of Richard Sillant, his quote was to the effect that we don't give the U.S. public what it wants. We give them what we want them to have. So you'll never find out what really is going on.
Of course.
You'll only find out what they want you to know, what they want you to believe. The manipulation of the public mind, propaganda, but it's just gotten worse and worse and worse over the years. And of course, the proliferation of cable TV. And I need to watch it a little bit. Very painfully, Frank, because I do a little bit of media criticism.
Yeah.
And I find it very hard to distinguish between CNN and Fox News.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Very sadly, where you are, the BBC is pretty poor, too, as you know.
Yes. I think what we have to remember also is that media or, like, news, news wasn't sort of, I think, sorry, in a TV station, the news sort of department wasn't profitable to a point, which meant that, you know, there was entertainment, they're expecting to make money out of it, the movies, money out of it, but the news media was, you know, on its own, was special news. You don't make money out of news, but since, for about 20 years now, the news has become part, you know, got into the account and they now need to make money out of the news as well. That's why there's a competition. And you can see, as you said correctly, the coverage being Fox News or CNN, is pretty much the same. And because they need to make money out of the news, they need to have audience watching the news. So what sells goes on goes live. And if something doesn't sell, even if it's about thousands of people being killed, it just won't get to the air. And it's very worrying. And with internet and this sort of new media type, we've got activists around the world. We've got the opportunity to counteract the corporate media. And we saw this during the Gaza war as well. Israel completely blocked the entrance of Gaza to journalists, which they thought will enable them, it worked in a way, but enable them to do anything they wanted. But the thing, at least in the UK, the picture we got from Gaza was picture from activists in Gaza, so non-censured sort of pictures, which were even more horrible than what the media would have shown otherwise.
Oh, indeed, Frank. We need to take another break. Let's do that and come back, and we'll continue this story. It's a core topic on this program.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Along with Frank Barat, talking about the Russell Tribunal in Palestine. Oh, please, Frank, continue where you left off, and we'll range on all things related to this vital topic, but please continue.
I think I was talking about media coverage and the fact that, at least in the UK, because no journalists were allowed into Gaza during the war, we got most of the pictures we got and most of the videos we got were from activists on the ground. So uncensored pictures and videos, which were shocking, I think, to the eyes of the normal citizen who's not used to see pictures like this normally through the mainstream media. And again, Israel, shot itself in the foot and with, not allowing journalists to get into Gaza. Even if, on the other hand, it allowed Israel for about 3 weeks to do whatever he wanted on the ground, so bombing schools, mosques, bombing UN institutions, TV stations, and ambulances, pretty much anything that moved in Gaza. And what was interesting as well is, in my opinion, Israel made this out to be a war. But in my opinion, I think there was pretty much no war on Hamas part. There was actually pretty much no fighting happening in Gaza. I mean, there was, I think, about 10 Israeli or 11 Israeli soldiers died. 5 of them got killed through friendly fire, so which meant that for 3 weeks war on the ground in small little streets of Gaza, only 5 Israeli soldiers died, which I think proved that there was not much, in a way, fighting back from Hamas. And that's something that no one really talked about so far. But it's just very important to, and that's why we hope that through the tribunal we'll manage to do this. It's very important to bring the truth back, back into light, bring the truth about this conflict. It's not a religious conflict. It's not a humanitarian conflict. It's a political conflict that will be solved politically. And it's, the mainstream media, Israeli propaganda, U.S. propaganda, European propaganda, is more and more trying to make this conflict out of a humanitarian conflict. So send money to Gaza is like sending, in the 80s or mid-80s, rice to Ethiopia. That's not the problem. Gaza people and Palestinians in the West Bank are suffering because of the blockade, because of Israeli settlements, because of Israeli checkpoints. They're not suffering because they don't have enough rice. If we let them the opportunity, they will flourish and have businesses and have a normal life. It's a political conflict, and that's what people have to understand.
indeed it is a political conflict, and there are so many important truths that have been suppressed, including one vital one, when the U.S. media, and I would really Western media overall, but especially the U.S. major media, portray Palestinian elements as radicals and terrorists, going back at least 30 years or so, when the PLO was headed by Yasser Arafat, he pretty much came to the conclusion that we needed a peaceful settlement to this situation. It was outrageous from the very start that because of the Balfour Declaration back in 1917, here a country that for many, many centuries had been primarily populated by Arabs, by Palestinians. There were small numbers of Jews when they first began arriving, I'm not sure, but back in the early part of the last century.
It's important to, as you said rightly, there was Jewish people living with Palestinians pre-48, and pre 36, because 36 where the Arab rebels started, but the coexistence between Jews and Palestinians in Palestine prior to the massive immigration was very good. You know, there was no problem whatsoever. So it's again showing that the media and the propaganda has transformed this. But you know, I've met older Palestinians that used to be the nanny of a young Jewish kid in early 20th century. So it's not a religious conflict. You know, Jews and Arabs have actually a lot more in common than people believe. Judaism and Islam is actually, I think, sometimes a lot closer than Judaism is to Christianity. And, I'll let you continue.
Well, indeed, that the three religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, have common roots.
Of course.
And the basic tenets of these three religions are essentially the same. Thou shalt not kill and love thy neighbor and things like that. So to portray one as superior and the other as some sort of demon, this is a political act. There's no question about it. Well, Jews and Arabs lived very well together when Arabs were the great majority of the people going back 100 years or more, and Jews were a very, very tiny minority. Where if the Arabs wanted to, they could have driven them all out very, very simply and easily, but they coexisted very well. I seem to recall, I've read many of Edward Said's books, The Great Palestinian American, now gone. We have to take another break. But I believe I remember he talked about, before his family had to leave Palestine, that he had Jewish neighbors and they got along just fine together when he was a small boy growing up.
In his memoirs, I've read it as well. Yeah, you're entirely right.
Oh, indeed. We need to take another break, Frank.
Okay.
Let's do it. We'll be back. And then only one more break for the next half of the program.
Great.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Frank Barat, talking about the Russell Tribunal in Palestine. Let me throw one more thing in, if I may, Frank. The great Israeli journalist Amir Haas had an article yesterday in Haaretz. You can get more real information on what's going on in the area. In Haaretz, a very well-established Israeli paper. You can read it in English. You can pick up their articles online. And she lived in Gaza, then she left, and then she came back, had a hard time getting in because the territory continues under siege. She was arrested. She literally was arrested. I think they're going to put her on trial because she tried to enter the territory, because she had entered and she was coming out. Pretty outrageous. She emphasized the article that she wrote. She wrote an article on some of the items that Israel is allowing in, given that the territory is under siege. And I've written a few articles on this myself, but prior to the siege that's been ongoing about a year and a half, and partially ongoing since Hamas was democratically elected, January 2006, I believe. 4,000 items used to be allowed in, all kinds of stuff that people need, take for granted as long as you can get it, and now it's down to about 30 or 40. Mm-hmm. Let me just read a couple of things that Israel bans from being allowed into Gaza. It really is astonishing. Many drugs, many foods, building materials, electric appliances. I don't know who can afford to buy them, but all parts, if you want a spare part for an old machine that you have, you can't get it. They also ban matches, books, musical instruments, crayons, clothing, shoes, mattresses, sheets, blankets, cutlery. Oh, Haaretz has a bouncing page. Shoes, cutlery, crockery, cups, glasses, animals, and it goes on and on. Let's see. Coffee, sausages. Pasta used to be, I think it may be allowed now. Milk in large packages, baking products, all kinds of industrial commodities. I mean, this stuff is banned. It has nothing to do with any conflict. It's just because Israel is so hardline.
I entirely concur, and which I think for me proves that what Israel is doing is not combating an enemy state or an enemy entity, is that actually depriving Palestinians of vital needs and essential needs. And it's the same when Israel, the Israeli army say, by inadvertence bombed the UN compound in Gaza, where all the food was stored for the Palestinians, not all the food, but most of the food was stored for people of Gaza. It's intentional, and it proves once more that what Israel is doing is not fighting an army of crazy Jew-hating people. What Israel is doing is fighting the Palestinian people as a whole and trying to reclaim what the Zionist project was all about. So Eretz Israel, the whole Israel from the Mediterranean to the Jordan Sea. And Ilan Pappe talks about ethnic cleansing, and the use of the word obviously is quite strong, and people often tend not to use it because they're scared of the backlash. But I think that's what's happening. It's a slow ethnic cleansing. It's not like in 1948 when through the war 700,000 Palestinians were ejected from Palestine, but it's like a drop-by-drop ethnic cleansing, and it's just making life impossible for Palestinians, either in Gaza or in the West Bank. And we have to remember about the West Bank as well, because during the Gaza onslaught or war, people on TV, so-called experts or Middle East experts were saying, look, the people of Gaza, if only you had voted for Mahmoud Abbas, who is for peace negotiations, who talks with Israel, who talks with the U.S., you could have the same life they've got in the West Bank. And obviously people don't know what life is in the West Bank, so people are like, yeah, they're right. They could have the life Palestinians have in the West Bank. But just go to the West Bank, and life in the West Bank, they've got to be more food than in Gaza, but life in the West Bank is very, very hard. There is more than 500 checkpoints. There is Israeli incursion in cities like Nablus, where there's no resistance anymore whatsoever, at least armed resistance. There is still Israeli incursion every single night in Nablus. They get into a place, trash the place, take the 17-year-old boy and, take him away, sometimes for 3 days, sometimes for an hour, sometimes for 6 months, for what they call administrative detention, which means that the person arrested has pretty much no right to habeas corpus, so no right for a trial, no right for a lawyer, no right to know what he's been arrested. And that's happening in the West Bank. That's happening in so-called Mahmoud Abbas territory, which is obviously not Mahmoud Abbas territory. It's Israeli-controlled territory. And to go back also on if only you'd be nice, wear a suit and act like Mahmoud Abbas and Salam Fayyad and follow the peace negotiations. I think peace negotiation, those two words now mean strictly nothing to the Palestinians. They speak of peace negotiations. How long do you negotiate for? I mean, it started, I can't even remember, 30 years ago, the negotiations. And throughout those few years, the Palestinians got strictly nothing. And not only they got nothing, but they lost even more. So for the Palestinians, peace negotiations means losing more land, seeing the youth being killed, more checkpoints, more wall. That's what peace negotiations mean to the Palestinians. But when they hear Benjamin Netanyahu saying, oh, we might start a new peace process, they get crazy, because a new peace process, what does it mean for them? Another 40 years of walls and checkpoints? And it's a very bad situation.
Oh, absolutely. The so-called peace process, by different names, one of the more recent ones called the roadmap, it is all subterfuge, all theater. There absolutely is no intention on the part of Israel in pursuing peace. And one of the things that I wrote about a couple of times, I quoted a former Israeli prime minister, Shamir, back in the 1980s. He talked about there was a political crisis because things had gotten too calm. Israel needs violence to convince the public at large that a serious threat exists from these terrible Palestinians. And if there really is a peace offensive that the Palestinians want to pursue, then Israel needs to take every measure possible to see that it's disruptive to go back to this culture of violence to justify everything that they're doing, this very hardline policy in the West Bank. The West Bank, plain and simple, is a militarized police state. And as you say, Frank, the Israeli military and other security forces and Israeli settlers, every settlement is given arms and they can use them freely. They can shoot Palestinians with virtual impunity, so the Israeli military and even settlers can break into a Palestinian's home. They can beat them up. They can rape the women. They can shoot the men. They can arrest the boys. They can do anything they please and get away with it. And there is absolutely no judicial redress for Palestinians. Once in a very, very, very great while, something can happen in the way of redress, but it's so rare that you basically have to conclude that, first of all, Palestinians can only go into a military court. They can have advocates represent them in other courts, but they'll basically accomplish nothing. Again, once in a while, something happens, a benefit here, a crumb there, a victory here, or whatever. But in the vast majority of cases, they get no redress against the most grievous crimes committed against them. And, oh, Frank, I've written so much about so many examples. It is really heart-rendering to think if you simply forget Jews and Arabs and just talk about people and just imagine that person A does this to person B, well, my goodness, if it happened in your own neighborhood, you'd be absolutely appalled by this. Or if there was a so-called news report that person A did this to person B without identifying the kind of people they are, you would be appalled by that. Well, this goes on every single day in the West Bank and, of course, in Gaza, too. It is absolutely outrageous.
And again, it's a matter of how you show the people. I mean, the media has completely dehumanized the Palestinians. And just looking at the coverage, for example, when the settlers were taking off Gaza in 2005, again, it was showed everywhere during the media. I used to live in France, and I was appalled by the media coverage. It was like a 24-hour newscast of 7,000 settlers, illegal settlers. So it's not a favor they're doing to the Palestinians. It's just respecting international law. Again, they're illegal settlers. So about 7,000 of them controlling one-third of the West Bank, where a million and a half Palestinians were living, were taking, so were, you know, pulled out of the Gaza Strip. To be, I mean, it's important to mention that they were pulled out of the Gaza Strip to be relocated in the West Bank, so in illegal settlements in the West Bank. The media coverage, you could, you know, you heard stories, you know, like camp, like news report going into houses of Israeli settlers, and, you know, hearing the story, people crying. So, you know, you felt very close to those people in a way. But when the Gaza war happens and 1,400 Palestinians dies, no one goes to see a family. Like, you didn't have any news report going to see the family of Mohammed Abu Salem something and talking about you lost your daughter, but how did you, you know, what was your work before? Did you used to work in Israel? We didn't have this. So on one hand, dehumanization of the Palestinians, and on the other hand, like this over coverage of Israelis. But I think it's part of a global. You were mentioning that Israel needs war to sort of survive or strive. It's very important to remember also that I think Israel was hit by a recession in 2000, 2001. You know, the economy was very floundering. And, you know, with September 11th and the whole homeland security, and Israel now is number one in homeland security, is number one in building walls, is number one in training armies all over the world for counterinsurgency attacks, is number one in new weapons. So Israel, in a way, uses like the West Bank and Gaza as his laboratory to test new weapons, test new wall. The wall being built in Mexico will probably have Israeli experts working on. Any hostage situation involves now the Mossad anywhere around the world. And so I think it goes for Israel. It goes for the U.S. as well. The U.S. since the end of the communism era, not the end of the communism era, the end of the USSR, had to find another enemy to, you know, to build more weapons, to make more money, and they turned to Islam, and Islam is the new red menace, and that's why the Palestinians are in the middle of all this and cannot really do anything about it. You've got the big power of the U.S. saying that, you know, when September the 11th happened, who was Ariel Sharon, said Arafat was his bin Laden. And people fell for it.
Oh, indeed. And bin Laden, as we've mentioned on this program, was a CIA asset back in the 1980s, probably also in the 1990s, and heaven knows, maybe he is now. Not that he knows it. I say asset, not agent. He certainly doesn't get a paycheck every month from the CIA, but working through organizations like the Pakistani Secret Service, their ISI. But we use these people, and this myth about you're right. The former Red Menace, going back decades and decades, Frank, and now it's the great Islamic menace or the clash of civilizations. Samuel Huntington wrote about this hideous man who taught at the same school that I went to. Thankfully, I never had any association with him.
No, I was saying bad luck. You were in the same school, in the same school that Samuel Huntington.
It makes my blood turn cold just thinking about it. That these are the kind of people that teach the young kids. I can't imagine what these kids come away with when they attend classes of a man like this. And he's only one of many. And he had distinguished universities that put people on. That people on the faculty who rise to prominence because their ideology is so bloody evil, and that makes them prominent figures. And
listening to you, I had the name of Alan Dershowitz popping in and out of my mind constantly.
Oh, he's one of the worst. He absolutely is one of the worst. A frequent guest in this program is Francis Boyle. Very well known, distinguished international law expert, teaches at the University of Illinois. He has written about don't send your children to Harvard Law School because people like Alan Dershowitz teach there. So we have war criminals or people who support war crimes teaching young law students the law. Well, they might first learn what the law is before they try to teach it.
But I think that's why it is very important once more to because for a lot of people, because again, you know, people work, as Dolly Parton would say, 9 to 5, take the underground or the subway, go home, eat, and watch the news, and you know they've got most of the people do, you know, work like this. They don't have time to actually go further than, you know, the 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock news, and it's very important to go beyond this propaganda, and it's very important for people to understand that if you are pro-Palestinian, and again, even the term pro-Palestinian is the wrong term for me, just being pro-justice, and that's why the tribunal, the Russell Tribunal in Palestine, focused on international law. It's being pro-justice. We're not subjective. We're not going to create something out of our mind because we either anti-Semitic or self-hating Jews. We are just going to follow international law. So it's not biased. It's just a people, the Palestinians, being massacred now and then, and at least dispossessed pretty much every day by a superpower. Israel is a superpower. When I hear Netanyahu, does he mean a commercial break? Is it the last one?
Oh, it's the last one, and then we have a few minutes. Let's take the break, Frank, and then you finish up the last few minutes. Maybe give a little explanation of the kind of people that will be on the tribunal.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. Final few minutes with Frank Barad on the Russell Tribunal in Palestine. Frank, explain who's on the tribunal, when the work will begin, and I guess it will go on for an extended time.
Okay. As we've got only a few minutes left, if anyone wants to know more about the tribunal, the best thing to do would be to go on our website, which is RussellTribunalOnPalestine.com, one word. So how are we going to work? We started with a list of patrons or supporters. Our list is now, there's more than 150 prominent names on our list. Noam Chomsky's on our list, Judith Butler, we've got journalists, we've got Tariq Ali from the UK, we've got the Ken Loach, UK filmmaker, Norman Filkenstein, Eduardo Galeano, writer from Ukraine, Naomi Klein. We've got a list of people from all over the board. So we've got activists, we've got academics, we've got actors, we've got Jews, and that's very important to emphasize this. We've got a lot of Jewish supporters on our panel. So the tribunal is going to work in a few sessions. The first step is to establish national committees all around the world. So we're working at the moment on establishing committees in the UK, in France, in Belgium, in Spain, Portugal, Australia, Canada. We really hope in the next few weeks to start working on a US national committee, even if the US is a massive country. But if anyone actually wants to contact us, and if anyone that listening today is interested in hearing more about how to create a national committee, please contact us through the website again. To establish a committee, you either need to be an organization, or you either need to be an expert in something, international law, history, or else. So then once the committee will be established all over the world, we're going to have sessions, so public sessions, because it's, again, a public event. Public sessions, we'll have expert sessions. So experts will work on one subject. For example, in France, people are going to focus on the arms trade. So who's selling arms to Israel? Is it legal? Is it illegal? What type of arms are being used? In Spain, we hope to focus on the EU complicity in all this. So experts will work on certain subjects. And then we'll have hopefully two or three sessions before the final sessions. which, I mean, the first big session we hope will happen early 2010, maybe March 2010, the first big session of the tribunal. We don't know yet where it will happen, but definitely be in a big capital city. So it could be New York, it could be London, it could be Johannesburg. We're working on this now. But once more, the goal is to have public opinion behind us. It is it's actually a democratic tribunal. It's about the people taking the power back. You know, the institutions and different countries actually do not respect what they preach, and hopefully us, the people, are going to show them that they should respect it and that the world would be a much better place if they did respect it. That's it's a big, big task, but it's our task. And as I think Bertrand Russell, or no, it was Jean-Paul Sartre, who was president of the Tribunal of Vietnam, said that we hope that the legitimization of the tribunal will come afterwards. If the masses, public opinion agrees with our judgment, it will become truth.
Frank, I'm going to cut you off because
that was my break.
I hope you'll keep me posted, and you have an open invitation to come back anytime.
Okay.
I had Ian Douglas from the Brussels Tribunal on. Mm. Your work is important, and I want to promote it any way I can.
Thanks a lot, Stephen.
My great thanks to you for coming on.
Thank you, Stephen.
Join us again tomorrow, another live program, more important discussion. Join us then.